Today's scripture comes from two portions of the New Testament, the Gospel of John, chapter 13, verses 34 and 5, which are printed in your bulletin, and Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 13, verses 4 through 7. The Corinthians reading is from what is called the Love Chapter, and if you've been to a wedding in the last 30 years, you've heard it. I give you a new commandment, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. You also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious, or boastful, or arrogant, or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. The Word of God. Thanks be to God.
Good morning. As we start a new series today for the next 3 weeks on what exactly is a Christian, what does it mean, what is the power of that word, we want to have a little bit of a teaser. There's no shortage of entries on the internet. I think one of the postings was 1.5 million posts came up like that when someone Googled what is a Christian. Strikes me today that people all over the world are making those inquiries, wondering, what does it mean? What does it mean to be a Christian? So right out of the gate this morning in my talk, I'd like you to ponder silently, what is a word that you think of that comes to mind when you hear the word Christian? Is it a positive word? Is it a negative word? Is it maybe just a neutral word? Like, oh yeah, just one of the monotheistic religions of the world. There are a lot of people out there who have decided to use the term Christ follower instead of Christian because of some of the baggage that goes along with the word Christian over the course of history. There are plenty of people who have been turned off by the church and don't ever see themselves affiliating with anything that smacks of Christian. Not a Christian gathering of people in a room like this. Not picking up a Christian book at a Christian bookstore or listening to a Christian radio station or Christian anything. Findings and surveys from those who don't consider themselves Christian but would very much consider themselves spiritual. And there's a lot being written about that group here in the last few years. As I have looked at some of the studies, some major studies out there, the Barna group being one, different parts of the world have conducted these surveys. And it crystallized, it kind of boiled into one that really got on my radar this year when I saw a variety of comments were distilled in this response, that people do not see themselves as Christian because they say Christians are judgmental, homophobic moralists who think they're the only ones going to heaven and who secretly relish the fact that everyone else is going to hell. Ouch. That's kind of sad, isn't it? I am troubled some days by how we, the so-called followers of Christ, have created an image of Christ that a lot of people run away from scared. I get it why Mahatma Gandhi would say, I like your Christ, but I don't like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ, who saw worth in every person. So to get this series started today, about what it means to be Christian, I thought we could start with the one thing. You know, the one thing. The one thing that he asked all his friends to sign up for, that they would love one another. That's the one thing. How did he say it? He said, okay, love one another as I've loved you. And in John's gospel, the fourth writer of the gospel, some people have trouble reading John because it's so full of metaphors and all this imagery. But it's pretty clear Jesus just like the other three Gospels, was getting down to this one set of instructions. If you boil it down to one thing, people will know you belong to me by the way you are loving other human beings. And that is how those first century followers of Jesus did come to be known, for their love for one another. In fact, there's some writings of people who were in the Roman Empire that observed the Christians and said, oh, look how they love each other. It's amazing. The way that they would care, the way they'd pool their resources and distribute them across the church according to need. I'd like to imagine that the way the early church operated was like that hillside picnic one day where people were gathering, they were hungry, there wasn't enough food to go around, but the way Jesus stood with them and called out their best, a miracle happened and everyone had enough food. I'd like to think that the early church was like that all the time. But don't you and I know better? Community life is never that easy. There's always the tug and the pull of wills and people's agendas here and there. But from all the stories that we pick up on Jesus, especially this one today that you heard Alan read from John, it's some of the last instructions that he gives people. He has a few talks like this in the Gospel of John. He's getting ready. He knows his time is limited. And it's as if he's saying, okay, guys, everything we've done together over these last 3 years, what you've seen me say and do, the healings, comes down to this. Make sure you're loving people. Just one thing. How are you loving? Jesus keeps it simple. He doesn't tell them what to believe, really, over the course of his ministry. He tells them more what to practice. You know, it's less orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is that you have a perfect set of beliefs, doctrinally pure. Jesus wasn't so much about that. He was really big on the orthopraxy. Are you practicing what you have heard me do and say in a way that it will show up? There'll be evidence in your life that you're following me when people watch how you behave. And then he leaves it up to them and to us to figure out what that kind of love is to look like. That self-emptying, forgetting yourself and giving ourselves over to something greater than ourselves. That's the kind of love. This tenacious, demanding, beautiful, big love that changes the world. Ann Howard is an Episcopal writer from Santa Barbara. I like how she writes. In fact, I'm channeling a couple of her points here in my talk today because I like how she expresses it. But she asks, how did we get from Jesus' instructions 2,000 years ago to the way the church more struggles and hair splits and can't be with each other because of the way we disagree on ritual and doctrine and fighting over creeds? It's happened not just lately. It's happened for 2,000 years. The fights that go on about who's right and who's wrong. If you read anything about Christianity, you'll come into these kinds of debates. In some ways, they're good because it means people are taking their beliefs seriously. But it makes one scratch one's head when we cannot stay in the same room with each other when we disagree. It's like there's this big religious living room. Think of the living room in a large, generous home where there's space for a lot of people to be sitting around the walls. And one person of our, and one place in the 21st century religion living room are the liberals sitting on a soft, generous sofa. And they believe, you know, the specifics of what you believe is not so important. It's you having an intention of love in your actions. Yeah, I'm there most days. But they look down their noses at their cousins on the other side of the room, the conservatives who are sitting in their straight back chairs, for whom scriptural inerrancy is very important, and having social traditions that you do not deviate from are important. And the two have trouble talking to each other. I digress. Just one thing. Love one another. I am interested in that kind of love and what it looks like in the 21st century, not just for Jesus' followers way long time ago. How does it look in our public lives? Can people look at our behavior and know who we belong to? Those first Christians were known for their love. So how might we be known in our time, in our schools, in our commerce, in our community governments? How about being known for standing up in love to the gun lobby? and loving support of children like Emily Hill, age 11, her brother Gregory, age 13, who lost their lives exactly a week ago right now in Sutherland Springs, Texas, when a church was busted into with a killer with evil intent. And that huge circle of grief that that community must now work through. I hope you're praying for them this morning. All the church should be. You know, clinging to a strong, demanding love these days could just be enough to move our Congress from mere background check legislation to the now defunct assault gun rifle ban that was once in place. I know, I've heard the debate, I've entered into the debate, and I hear people and with political position and people who know the way the economy and law enforcement works, they say, you can't do it. It's impossible to get such action. And I wonder, is impossible as loaves and fishes feeding the whole crowd on the hill? Is it as impossible as the empty tomb 2,000 years ago? That's the corner of what we gather for? One thing, love one another with a tenacious, demanding love. You know, in my lifetime, and maybe in your lifetimes too, is if there's one person who held up this understanding of a strong, backboned love that could stand up against all that would oppose it, all that was less humane than love, it would have to be the person of Martin Luther King Jr. Just look at his writings. Just listen to some of his speeches, which really were sermons after all. You see this clear, clear message that all of love, strong love, that insists that people be treated with dignity and worth, that kind of love would breed more love if we gave that to the main thing we served. Martin King's determined conviction that love is the only way to truly unite people, even people of different religious orientation, even people who claim no religious affiliation, and those who do, could still gather under the umbrella of love for the common good. Martin King, his insights into the mechanism of how a love that was across all cultures, that was really brilliant and very advanced and powerful for his time. He learned much from Gandhi and from other practitioners of nonviolence, thinking that if you acted from a place of love, it's really in the end going to be the only solution to hate and violence. Yet that shines out in every one of his speeches. And it's what, you know, Dr. King wrote a lot about the power of love and the beloved community, he called it. It's what he held on to when he would meet with his nonviolent demonstrators in places like Selma. And when the orientation, they had a lot of practice about how you will not respond with the same anger and vitriol of how people treat you. He taught them that when you are sitting on the ground and people come to you with the fire hoses and the attack dogs and with saying, calling you names that you have never heard before, he said, you look at them and you imagine the dignity and the sacred worth that's in them. You appeal to the imago Dei in them, and you insist on them rising to the top and living in a world of dignity with you. That is a demanding love. That isn't just Valentine's Day, but it's revolutionary. It's the kind of love Jesus embodied. So I've been chewing all week on a couple of quotes of Dr. King, because I think when we get into this notion of Jesus' instruction of how to live, we need to pay attention to the more contemporary prophets who knew how to put that into play. So here's one that I've been thinking about a lot. I think there's a lot of meat in this, if you'd hear it with me. Dr. King said, I'm not talking about emotional bosh when I talk about love. I'm talking about a strong, demanding love. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. This is why right, even temporarily defeated, is always stronger than evil triumphant. Justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love. Hold on to that. Justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love. And then there's also the front of your bulletins with a great line of Dr. King's that I'd like to have be part of my mantra. How about you? I've decided to stick with love, for hate is too great of a burden to bear. It's this kind of strong, demanding love that will stand up to powers that oppose, that would lessen the dignity of people, and demand that they be humane and fair and honorable. We don't do that just when we claim to be a Christian. Hold on to that name. Oh, I joined a church. I guess I'm a Christian now. It's really saying, I am a Christ follower, which means taking on that kind of love when it is inconvenient, when it is countercultural, when it is not popular. And self-emptying, self-giving, wildly extravagant love that is grounded in the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jesus and Paul. You know the name Isaac Dennison? Isaac Dennison, she's a great author and wrote a number of books. Probably the most popular was Out of Africa, made into a film, Robert Redford, big Meryl Streep, great movie. In the book Out of Africa, she tells the story of a young Kikuyu boy in Africa who comes to the home of the protagonist, the woman in the story. She owns a home, kind of a compound there in Africa. And the boy's a great worker, and she loves employing him, and he's doing well. But after about 3 months, he comes up to her and he says, I wonder if you would give me a letter of recommendation. I'm going to be going to find a different job now. I'd like to see if I could go apply for a job for Sheikh Ali bin Slim, who was a Muslim man who lived just in the next village. The woman knew him, but she was really surprised. What's gone wrong? We were getting on so well. You were advancing. I'll pay you more money if you would like. But he was not interested in money. He said, no. I decided in becoming a man that I would choose to either be a Christian or a Muslim. So that is why I came to work for you, because I heard that you were a Christian. But now that I've seen how you are, I now want to go and learn the Muslim way. And once I have observed that, I'll make my decision of what religion to live. In the story, the writer, Miss Dennison, says she wished that he had told her that when he'd first arrived. One thing. Love one another. So I began my talk by asking, what's a word that comes to your mind when you think of the word Christian? And I really want to affirm it is a really good word. It is a word so full of promise and redemption. Even if we, the very human church of 2,000 years, have heaped such a load of baggage around it that sometimes misses the point. Did you know that the word Christian only shows up a couple of times in the New Testament? Some think it first showed up in Athens when people who were not Christian observed how these people who were following Jesus' ways. And they said, rather as a put-down, look at those Christians. We who are Methodists, United Methodists, should warm up to that illustration, though. Because if you know just a little bit of our beginnings, it was John and Charles Wesley and his friends in the Holy Club on the campus of Oxford when they met and had what they called their Holy Club, meeting to do Bible study and fast and give alms for the poor and the prisoners, that their classmates looked down their noses at what weirdos these were who would get up in the morning and pray. They were so methodical, you bunch of Methodists. The name stuck in both counts. But a Christ follower is someone who will try to put into each of our days the expression, the evidence of a self-emptying love that points to something greater than myself. How are we doing with that? So let me end my talk with a haunting question. Some questions are meant to make us stirred and maybe make us lose a little sleep. I think this is one of those questions, and I mean it for myself as much as to you. I care less anymore about people having perfect set of beliefs and having that aligned with doctrines and creeds of the church historically, I find I care less and less about that. And I care more and more about behaviors showing up that emulate and model the way Jesus lived. So you remember the boy in the novel who decided he'd seen how a Christian acts, now he'd go see how a Muslim acts. So my question is, if someone spent only a few days around you, what marks of your behavior might say that you are a Christian or not? Amen.